the entertainment capital of the world, of Las Vegas, Nevada. It's Midnight in the Marshaverse, starring Marsha Warfield and her two sons, Stephen Roberts and Gills Hudson, as the problem child.
Oh, hi. Welcome to Midnight in the Marshaverse. You caught me checking my notes to make sure I have everything all ready and right. This has been a very stressful period between Tuesday night and Tuesday night. We usually tape the show or record the show because, you know, I'm old, so I say tape. I know you don't tape. I also say play records. So just pretend like you understand. Anyway, we recorded last week's show on election night. And that was a big downer, and everybody's been depressed ever since. But that shit is over. It's time to accept our fate. Let's move on and go win this thing. So, welcome to Midnight in the Marshaverse. This is the point in the day when yesterday becomes tomorrow, even while it's still today. It's amazing. And so, This is the witching hour. This is the woman's hour. And it's where women nurture and, you know, the hustle and bustle and competitive nature of the male species all day long. And I'm the winner and the boss. It's time at nighttime for the softer side of life. And so some of us are just drawn to it as children of the night. And I always have been. And so we like to have a more chill vibe than most shows and most folks usually do that we're used to. I like to start the show introducing my refreshments for the evening. They're usually some sort of form of cannabis and cognac. And tonight is no exception. For cognac, I have like a corner of this Remy, but I have some coffee in my sherry, my tamarind.
Ooh,
my tamarind cup. And it also, it has coffee and original Bailey's, Bailey's salted caramel, and Mozart chocolate liqueur. So I'm going to refresh it with a little splash of that yak. And I feel fine. For cannabis, this week, we're going to pull out the big guns. This is our Whoop Fam Zenko. And this is for when we've had a stressful week. And, you know, it's only once a week that we get down like this. And so we're going to get down like that. Turn it on and then push it. And you can see it starts to fill up. And we're going to take a hit. And that just set me off nice for the rest of the show. Of course, in our comediosophy segment where I explain the relationship between reality and comedy, and we comediosify a subject, of course, we're going to start with our current situation where we have been, we've been co-opted by Donald Trump. Sometimes you just have to take a moment and go, what the fuck? And then you calm down and ask that question more quietly. I think to start, I founded the Church of Jesus because I realized that my values are diametrically opposed to the values I was indoctrinated with. That hyper-masculine male, might makes right, kind of marine mindset that America has, where women are second-rate citizens, where black people are second-rate citizens, where gay people are second-rate citizens. I'm all three. I don't buy that. And I think that when you stay in that mode, everything you've been taught is a lie, you know? And I think that sometimes what we call religion, what we call philosophy, all those things are masculine attempts to control feminine nature. Nature is feminine. Nature is life. Nature gives life. Women give life. When you don't, you want to have some control, you try to impose rules on nature, but nature don't play that. She just lays back in the cut and lets you figure out what you're going to do, and then does whatever she's going to do. And if you don't believe that, ask a dinosaur. They probably thought they ran shit too. But in America, for some reason, in the United States, I've noticed that, for one thing, black people have always existed almost in the shadows, in broad daylight, but in the shadows. We're supposed to be, you know, you walk on the sidewalk, we're supposed to walk in the curb. I mean, and so everything we've done, all of the innovations we've made have been done by people making a way out of no way. And every 20, 30 years or so, it seems like throughout American history, this country loses its mind. It just goes fucking crazy and it gets all offbeat and people start running around like the hair's on fire, and everybody gets on the 1 in 3 and gets off the 2 in 4. And then when they get tired of that frenzied kind of thing, they look for black people to come save them. And every time we come up with a new beat that gets everybody to just slow down and chill, and then we can all get along for a period of time until the cycle starts again and the whole world becomes what do you call it? One of them horror rock songs, zombie shit. And so now it's time for us to take the temperature down again, come up with a new song, and get everybody to understand that it's not always a competition. It's not always about who's got the most. Sometimes it's better if everybody has enough than if a few people have a lot and the rest of us have to divvy up the crumb. So hopefully we'll get everybody back on the 2 and 4. I do my part every one of these shows that we do episodes. We also have a playlist of some of my favorites from my 70 years of R&B, funk, jazz, whatever, whatever. And I put them into one hodgepodge playlist and put it and have it accompany the show, so that if you wanted to, you could watch this show with the sound, with the audio, but still have, you know, this funk soundtrack like a movie in the background down low, or listen to it anytime you feel like it. We have to take the rhetoric down. We have to understand that we are by nature curious and friendly and vagabonds. We love to travel. We love to meet new people. Left to our own devices, I think we'd cooperate a lot more. But people who want a bigger piece, they kind of try to write a different narrative. We have the tools to write our own narrative. We have our own history, and we have our own vision of the future. And what happened with, and I always said that from the beginning when Kamala Harris first started running, I said, this is now a contest for the soul of this country. Are we going to be an aggressive, competitive, bully kind of, I get mine, and competitive country? Or are we going to be a more feminine, cooperative, diplomatic kind of respect for other people country? And country made its choice because they can't understand, since we haven't had it pretty much ever, but they can't understand the strength of feminine power, even though I don't know why they all have mothers. They all have sisters. They all, men with wives, women with wives, we all understand feminine power when we experience it. We just haven't really conceptualized it and made it a thing. When I went to the Wright Museum in Detroit, and they have a wonderful, wonderful, I don't know what you call it. It's a section that takes you through a slave ship, takes you on a slave ship from Africa through the Middle Passage. And it's, you know you're in a mock-up, but it's very harrowing and sobering. But then they told us about life in Africa and how the king was, his power was absolute and he ran everything and no one could defy the king. He didn't answer to anyone but his mother. His mother could come along and negate anything she didn't approve of. He had to have her approval. As a child, I noticed that we as Black people were matriarchal. And left to our own devices, I think it's a good thing, you know. And that's not to say Papa ain't with Mama, but that's to say when her family needs to feel like a family, they seek out that maternal thing for life. And when we lose our mothers, we tend to grieve very deeply. I'm sure everyone does. But the focus of strength, we always have appreciated our mothers and understand, men understand that that's their strength too. And so I believe that we have to start embracing that feminine in all of its different permutations, you know, whether she's femme femme or butch or whatever, or trans, gay, whatever. That feminine is missing, and we won't survive until we understand that we're out of balance and start to respect women. And Black women, and Black women's unique position. I'm getting ready to stop talking in a minute, but Black women's unique position in this country. We live in a patriarchal, white supremacist nation. White men have placed themselves on top. They have been ordained by their white Jesus to have domain on earth. But white women are still white, but they are women. And Black men are still men, but they're Black. So they have both have something in common with white men. Black women don't never have. And so they see the whole picture from a whole different perspective. And until that perspective is recognized and understood and that it's innate and that there was no social network that said, okay, all of us vote for Kamala Harris. I mean, we talked about it on, but it wasn't like, 90% of people doing anything is remarkable. And that's on a whole nother level. And because of that unique understanding, I think we would have taken our country forward in leaps and bounds just by electing a Black woman who happens to be more than competent and confident and ready to do the job and strong enough to do it well. My fellow Americans, Aunt Karen's Suburban Seasonings Casseroles in a Can, on behalf of our parent company, USA Corp Incorporated, and our new CEO and titular overlord, Donald Trump, we encourage all citizen employees to stock up on our new FAFO Ready Rations line of freeze-dried, frozen, and canned foodstuffs designed to fill you up and last forever. With tasty treats like Aunt Karen's Suburban Seasonings, Fat Meats Greasy, lard and lima bean casserole in a can for dinner, and delicious breakfasts like Aunt Karen's Suburban Seasonings, He-Man, She-Woman, lima bean flakes, and excess breast milk casserole in a can, you and your family will be ready, willing, and able to withstand the endless global wars and most devastating national disasters. So loyal subjects, add these taste treats to your Bitcoin bank and credit monthly wish list. Now, before you run out of chits and scripts and end up conscripted yourself, we'd hate to lose even one more citizen customer family to the void. This man is a legend, and he has a place in comedy history that should be celebrated and taught in school. There was a shift and a level of just like popcorn popping burst open in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s. This man was very much involved in all of that. So won't you help me welcome Michael Williams. Hey, Michael.
Hey, Marsha, how you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing well. Doing well.
Thank you for staying up and hanging out with us. You ain't drinking with me. That's all right. I can drink by myself.
Yeah, it's a little late to drink for me.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I understand. You started the Comedy Act Theater.
Yes, I did.
In Leimert Park.
Yes.
In what year?
It was actually August 1985.
Now, I've told this story before. I'm going to tell it real quick. While we were at the Comedy Store, all the black comics hanging out in the back, waiting to go on if Paul Mooney don't show up. And when he showed up, we were all deflated, you know. And I was sitting next to Robin Harris. And Robin one night turned to me and said, I can't do this no more. I'm going home. And I said, what do you mean? He said, I'm going back south. You know, I'm going to do the clubs there. I got to get paid. I can't wait, sit around waiting for this. And I said, okay, but the agents and managers and stuff, they come to the Comedy Store. You have a better, he said, I don't care. And then not long after that, enter Michael Williams and the Comedy Act Theater. How did you get started?
Well, I actually got started out of the need to want to laugh, to want to lift my spirits, because during that time, you know, my career just wasn't really, you know, going according to my plans. And I decided after feeling like things just weren't going right, I needed to lift my spirits. So I said, I need to go somewhere so I could laugh, but I didn't know where to go within my area, you know, my neighborhood, so to speak. And the only places I knew about was the Improv and the Comedy Store. So I chose to go to the Comedy Store because I had been there at least maybe 3 or 4 times. And I believe I had gone to the Improv maybe once. And I went there midweek. And was the first person there. And I remember when I walked up, they demanded both my admission money and my drink money all at the same time. So it was almost like before I even sat down, my two beers were already waiting on me. And okay. I'm like, they know how to get their money. So I ain't mad at them. And so I sat there waiting for the show to start. And eventually a guy came out, a white guy that obviously ended up being the host of the evening, started to do his little thing, you know, on stage. And when he
got finished, comedy thing.
Yeah, when he got finished, he introduced the first comic. After that, he introduced the next comic, and then the next comic, and then the next comic, then the next comic. And that's when I said, these people basically have robbed me of my money because nobody's funny. and I'm not getting my money's worth, but I was determined to stay there the whole night just so I felt like I was going to get my money's worth. Then, oh, wow, it seemed like finally somebody black walked in. I said, about time somebody else here that could at least absorb some of this misery. And that's when I noticed this guy, you know, the black guy kept walking, and he walked behind the stage. And I said, well, maybe he's a comedian, and maybe he's going to perform. Maybe he's going to lift my spirits because he's black. Well, he ended up being a comedian. He ended up being the last comedian. And I said, just like white folks, they always put the brother on last. I said, that's cold-blooded.
Yeah.
But what was remarkable about that was he turned out to be worse than all the white guys. And I'm like, man, this is messed up. You know?
Okay.
I mean, here we got one representative and he's going to blow it, you know?
He blew it for the whole race.
Yep. So anyway, I decided, you know, to somewhat give him a pass. And, you know, he decided to do his last little act. And he ended up putting on what looked like a choir robe. It was a green choir robe. And it made me think about the drape from, the green drape from, what's that, Gone with the Wind.
Okay.
And
the Carol Burnett version.
Yeah, and so I said,
Yeah,
so I said, okay, well, what is he trying to do with this? And he grabbed a book. And he started acting like he was a black preacher. And I said, you know what? I can relate to this because at least I grew up in a black church and I know where he's trying to go with it. It wasn't all that funny. But in the moment, I said, I can relate to this. And that's when I said, man, this would be great if it was all black. Then the light came on.
Okay. And so how'd you go from, I had a good show, and you ain't gonna name this dude in the green robe, huh?
Yeah, T.J. McGee.
Okay, all right.
You know, who unfortunately passed a few years ago.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah.
But how'd you go from this one night of bitter disappointment to decided, well, to take the reins into your own hand and build you a chapel?
Well, partly because I've traveled doing entertainment shows across the country. And I felt like I had a pretty large enough network to somewhat understand that comedy has not been something that's been in the forefront at that time for us as a standalone medium. Yes, there were comedians around that I would see from time to time because they either filled in for, you know, a light going out on stage or they were the opening act or they were just in there to just, you know, kind of like waste time or not waste time, but, you know, fill in that empty space until the actual show, you know, started. Right. And so they always, in my opinion, considered like second class citizens. And I didn't think too much of it until I realized that in that moment at that show that night, that nobody really had ever really come to me and said, Michael, you got to go see all these comedians. Or Michael, let's go to a comedy show. And I ended up, when I realized that was something that I was going to make happen, I called family and friends across the country and asked them, how often do they go to comedy clubs? You know, how many comedians do you know? You know, which black comedians do you know? And for the most part, they were all about the same. Richard Pryor, Flip Wilson, Whoopi Goldberg, Eddie Murphy, Bill Cosby, Dick Gregory, and Red Fox. That was typically all they knew about because these are the people that we all back then, for the most part, saw on TV. At least.
So how did you go from that to I'm going to get me a club? I'm gonna get I'm gonna put on a show in my barn. How did you get to that?
Well, what made me realize I had to do something was the fact that night I went to lift my spirits. And that night, I recognized that if I needed to have my spirits lifted, I'm no different from any other Black person, more than likely in this country, that probably from time to time needs that same lift. And that's why I said I started calling around, asking people, you know, how often do they go to comedy clubs and who do they know? And damn near 99.9% of the times they all said, we don't go to comedy clubs. We don't know.
So how'd you find a talent pool? How'd you find, what made you seek out a particular location? You know?
Well, I knew what my strengths were. My strength was in my own neighborhood. My strength was in my network of people. And, once I located a facility, then I started to look for, how I was going to market to everybody to let them know I was about to do something nobody else was really doing. And then I started looking for the talent.
So enter Robin, right?
Well, Robin, I had met 5 years prior, just one time. And I had never forgot about him. For some odd reason, it was something about him that touched me. And I remember saying the night that I saw him perform, I said, man, he and Paul Mooney would probably be great on the show. Because I knew Paul from the 70s, known him for a good little while. And I just thought that those two individuals, if they were in the same room, sharing the same stage, that could be potentially a great show. Well, once I established a place and found comedians, I needed a host. And because I had known of Paul Mooney and the fact that when I was embarking on opening up this club, I wanted to penetrate the Hollywood entertainment as quickly as possible to let the industry know that, hey, there's a slew of Black talent just waiting to be discovered, and you need to come check them out. So Paul, I felt, had that connection. That's why I wanted him to be my host. And when I asked him, would he be my host of this new Black comedy spot that I was going to be doing, he just simply said, I don't want to do no nigga shit, and hung up on me. And that's when Robin Harris entered the room.
Okay, so Robin, we know, became almost synonymous with the Comedy Act Theater.
Yes.
It was his room. He was king of that.
Yes.
Whole revolution. It was a revolution. I've also told this story that at that time, all of the seeds that had been planted before started to come to fruition. Well, the earlier comedians and the actors who had demanded representation behind the camera and entry into the unions, now those people were starting to work. They were working in entry level, starting in the mailroom and stuff, but you started to have more Black people in the Hollywood machine.
Right.
From all aspects, from wardrobe to cameras, everything. And so now, and then those cable networks started making their, like the WB and stuff, and they all needed content. And then the Apollo and all those shows, those talent pools started to pay off. So now Black writers are writing shows that are getting, they can get in where they used to not be able to, because you got all these show, these networks that need content. And it just was a thing. And in Love and Color, and those shows took off and ignited an explosion of Black talent. And we've gone from where I grew up, and I'm sure you grew up, and never saw Black people on TV, to where children now can grow up and never have to watch TV that's not all Black. Right. Their entire life, they don't ever have to do mainstream if they don't want to. What is the impact of your input into the comedy book?
Well, if I'm to pat myself on the back, I would just simply say I gave the opportunity to now, a few generations deep, the ability to realize that they have the abilities to do what they feel that they are talented enough to do. I mean, there was a time, as you know, that the black talent pool in comedy was very, very small. Then all of a sudden, it's like, where are they coming from? And that was because they had a place where they could express themselves without being handcuffed. They were never told, hey, you're too black, or tone it down, or we're not trying to usher in your kind of people to be in our establishment, you know, because we kind of have our own crowd. And so I just felt like I gave voice to the voiceless.
I want to bring my two sons out. I know they have a question or so, if you'll stay with us.
Oh, yes.
Before we do that, give me some names. Give me some names that you've nurtured at the Comedy Act.
Okay, well, I would say Chris Tucker, Mike Epps, Bruce, some more, D.L. Ugly, Jamie Foxx, Joe and Guy Tori, Myra J., D.C. Curry.
That's a pretty impressive list. You ain't got to go no further. Yeah. You ain't got to dig no deeper.
And that's a combination of both my Atlanta club and my L.A. club. I'm also working on a book about the history of the Comedy Act Theater, which basically gives that whole story about how this explosion of this genre of talent came to be, and the lives that were changed, and that's whether or not they became big or, you know, decided not to even, you know, stay in the game, you know, at all. Unfortunately, to this day, there has been a total of 43 people that have walked across my stage that have already passed on. And it's like, who would have even imagined that one day it would have been that many people, you know? Yeah. And here we are, 1985, going on, it's been more than 39 years.
Yeah.
You know, that this whole train took off. And as of right now, it's not going to stop. And now, so I just wanted to say that a book will be coming out to celebrate the 40th anniversary of the opening of the Comedy Act Theater.
We're going to look for that. And when it does, I hope you'll come back and we'll talk about it and get into it.
Oh, definitely.
Okay. But right now, I want to introduce my oldest son. He's so precocious, looks just like me. He is a very funny man. I met with Rain Pryor, and he produces my one-woman show, The Book of Marcia, and does stand-up with no clothes on. Looks just like me. Please say hello to my oldest son, Stephen Roberts.
Hi, Michael.
Hey, how you doing, Stephen?
I'm great. How are you today?
Wow, you do look like your mother.
You know what? It's the glasses.
It is, you know. I think he looks like his dad when he's getting on my nerves. Anyway, this is the first time you've met Michael?
This is.
Yes.
And what an honor.
No.
Thank you.
Would you, being who you are, work in a club that was all black?
Oh, yeah. In fact, when I got to open for you at the Comedy Union, that was an amazing honor to be able to be invited to be on that stage. And it's an absolutely, absolutely. If they would have me.
You held your own, you know, and we've had this, you know, back and forth, black comics organ, white clubs, white comics organ, black clubs. And I found that the ones who do best, who are just people who do themselves. They're just themselves. If you're a nerdy guy, they'd be a nerdy guy. If they're streetwise white guy, they're street, you know, a hippie, whatever. It's the ones who think they have to adapt a persona or whatever. Those are the ones who usually fail. Because it comes off minstrelsy, you know. It's like, what are you doing?
Pandering.
Do you have a question?
Yeah, I have lots of questions, actually. But I think my biggest... I have two big questions. The first big question is, who did you know when they hit your stage for the first time? Who did you know they were going to be big time?
That's a very good question. Martin Lawrence, I would say, is definitely one. Robin Harris definitely was the another one.
What did Martin do on his very first time on your stage?
Got a standing ovation. And he had come the night before, and actually he tapped me on my shoulder and said, "Hey, I'm from DC, and here, this is the place. I've been living in LA now for a while, and I like to work the club." And I said, "Well, tonight's not a good night. Come back tomorrow night." And he came back tomorrow night, tapped me on my shoulder, and said, "I'm here." And I looked at my watch and I said, "Well, you're next." And he went right on stage and got a thunderous standing ovation. And when he came off, I put my arm around him and said, "Welcome to the family."
Okay. You're going to go far, kid.
Yeah. Mm. And that's one of the things that I will say was a plus for the club, was that I never needed to audition anybody. If you said, "I want to do comedy," well, then get your ass on stage, you know, because for me, it's not about you sinking or swimming. It's about repetition. It's about doing it again and again and again, because how else are you going to get better? Got to get on stage. And my thing was, get your ass on stage.
You know, you're either going to learn how to do it or you're going to quit.
Yeah. And I'll say, you know, some of the other folks, like, I never thought DL would have gotten as big as he got. I remember Monique and Samore and Bruce and DC Curry and Chris Tucker in their early days. And, you know, they were just okay. But they were also being schooled by those that were those that were coming from LA to Atlanta to kind of like show them what was going on in Hollywood, so to speak. And that was the likes of, you know, Joe Torre, Jamie Foxx, Ricky Harris, Chris Charles, and a few others. You know, they were kind of like my heavy hitters. That's but great. I can tell you a real quick story that was really, really interesting. April of 1990, I opened in March of 1990 in Atlanta, but I booked my first $1,000 show comic. And that happened to be Chris Rock. Okay. And because I was doing so well on the weekends, Friday and Saturday, with no name talent, I decided to book him Tuesday to Thursday, doing two shows a night, because I felt like that weekend money was my money. That wasn't his money. So we did two shows a night. And after the first show on the first night, he said, "Hey, man, these two guys are taking all the energy before I can get to the stage. So put me in the middle, but my money stays the same. Just put me in the middle." And those two guys were Joe Torre, who opened, and Jamie Foxx, who closed.
Wow.
And everybody got a standing ovation. So in essence, it was just a black comedy show.
Wow.
Okay. Everybody was kind of like equal, because all three of them were extremely funny.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, so, yeah. All comedy seeds at that time.
Yeah.
I'm going to bring on my baby boy, my problem child. I love him madly. He looks more like his father. But we're going to bring him out. And I know you know him. And when I said my problem child in rehearsal, when we were just talking, setting up the show, you said Skills. So let's bring out my baby boy, Skills Hudson. Hey, baby. Wow. How you doing?
Well, your boys look like twins.
You know, and they're a few years apart.
Came out first.
See, the power of woman.
It's the glasses.
Woman magic.
All right.
You know Michael, right? Skills?
Yes.
Yeah, I met Skills in LA years ago.
Do you work the comedy act?
No, I came in early 2000s, and I was at the time I was co-hosting for God Rest His Soul, D Militant. He was the one that introduced me to Michael. And I remember first time when I first met him after the show, he talked to me for like 3 to 4 hours in this Capri, what was that, Capri Classic? Capri, that big body. He's sitting up in there, and I was just, man, just soaking it all in, you know, and just, you know, it already preceded him. I already knew about him, but just the information he was giving me and the stuff and what he was saying about like repetition, study kept getting up, because back then I was real wordy. I was writing down everything, and he was like, you know what I'm saying, get up there, be more comfortable being yourself, you know what I'm saying, speaking your truth, you know what I'm saying, instead of trying to just write jokes. You know what I'm saying? Your jokes is what you feeling comfortable talking about your life.
Thank you for coming, like I said, and staying up with us and sharing your knowledge and experience. I'm sure it's going to be very valuable to a lot of people. And we look forward to your book to add to the collection of historical documents that must be preserved.
Okay.
And welcome you back anytime.
Thank you. All right. Love
and if I don't see you before, have a wonderful, wonderful holiday season for you and all of yours.
All right. And it's nice meeting you, Stephen, and Skills, good to see you again. And that was Crown Victoria.
Crown Victoria, yes.
Okay. You could have slept in that one.
Yeah. Okay, you guys.
All right. Take care.
All right. Good night. Take care. All right. Good night.
Well, wasn't that informative and engaging?
And history is history.
All that. Familiar.
There's no way that Mike can smoke any weed because his memory is crazy.
Yeah, but when we, you know, around this age, you can remember those details, you know, crystal clear. But ask him where his blue socks are. He'll know.
He don't know. Mm-mm.
So we've had quite a week. What was your reaction, Skills, when you found out the election results?
Man, it was in real time. So I was getting ready to close out a show. And so I was ready to go up there with the like, yeah. But then as the show was going and I'm watching it on the thing, it was like, you know, and so I'm dealing with these emotions and still trying to watch the show and get myself prepared to go up there and, you know, just be in the moment. And then I start drinking a little bit more than I usually would. And so then I remember I went and I laid on the stage and I was like, y'all, I need this moment. And and I laid on my back on the stage. You know what I'm saying? It was just like, damn, damn, damn. Like, yeah. You know what I'm saying? And you know, and like, go ahead.
Now, go ahead. Tell me.
I just felt like, when I was a little, I remember when I was, I might have been 14 or 15, and I remember seeing one of my good friends kissing this girl that I was really liking at the time. I had been buying all kind of penny candy, had got the Valentine cards, which, you know, the cartoons where you write a lot. I had bought a whole box for her, and to see her kissing one of my best friends, you know what I'm saying? I felt so devastated. That's how I felt America did me when they voted Trump in. I just felt like they cheated on me. Like, y'all making me feel all good. I know he was over there, but I felt like it's me. Y'all want me.
Oh, yeah. Now, I understand. That's a pretty good analogy of how things went. Steven.
You know that feel, if you've ever been in a car wreck and the car is really badly damaged and you get out of the car and you can't believe it happened? And the tow truck takes your car off to the tow lot because it's totaled. and you're thinking, and you go home and you wake up in the morning, you go, oh man, I don't have a car. You know, and your back hurts and you feel traumatized because it was scary. That's how I felt like I had been in a car wreck. I really did. I felt like, okay, when I wake up, you wake up in the morning, you think, you know, I'm a pretty positive person. I wake up in the morning, I'm like, okay, it's a new day. And I remember going, okay, oh yeah. And like just everything.
I know. I felt like, you know how when you're a little kid and let's say it's Christmas and you really, really want something for Christmas.
Oh boy.
And your parents have told you that they don't know if they can get it for you. But you just know you're going to get this thing you asked for because your parents always come through, even though they always say they don't know, you right. know, if they can get it for you. And wake up and you go looking for your thing and there's nothing there.
And they told the truth.
That's what I felt. And so.
And we're all reliving it right now. Right now, I can see it on all of our faces. Yeah. We're reliving it right now.
It's breaking all over again. So let's change the mood. The question of the day, the question of this date that I want to ask, I want you to just take your mind in another direction, put your thinking caps on. You know how there are certain foods that people say should not go together, like sugar on grits. What food do people eat that makes you mad?
Deviled eggs with anything.
Okay. What is it about deviled eggs?
Hard-boiled eggs are the most disgusting thing. And then if you take that yellow inside and then you whip it up and you put it back in the egg and it's rubbery and, oh, and it smells like egg. Smells, oh, so gross. And I'll eat cooked eggs that are hot, but I will not eat a jello-flavored egg. Or an egg-flavored jello, which is basically what it is.
I thought I liked eggs and deviled eggs until you described them. And now I never want to see one again.
You're welcome. You are welcome.
Thank you for that. Now they've become, you know, like old chitlins.
I saw the question you had sent to us that was going to be the question. I'm like, well, I don't even have to think about that one. I know what that one is already.
Yeah. Well, okay. Yeah, I don't eat chicken, beef, or pork, but when I was eating that and steak, I hate to see somebody eat steak and eggs. Ew. Steak and eggs, like, because I was a big bacon and egg sandwich. So if I'm eating bacon, egg, and then you got steak over there with egg, give me that egg. I could throw this egg on my sandwich. You got steak, deal with your dinner. Choice. That is a dinner choice. You can't dinner breakfast it up. You know what I'm saying? You're going to dinner breakfast your combo. You know what I'm saying? Now, you might well put some A1 sauce on your egg. You know what I'm saying? And some people do that. Ew, don't do, give me, you know what I'm saying? When I would eat steak with potatoes. It even sound right. Steak, potatoes, not steak, eggy. Steak, egg, lame. That's what it sounds like. It should go steak, egg, lame.
Well,
stay in your steak, egg, lame.
Yes, lame.
The food that just makes me mad is sweet cornbread. I don't understand sweet. I didn't like it when I was a kid with Jiffy mixed cornbread. Sugar don't go in corn. You should have. It should be coarse and it shouldn't be soft and mushy. And then you make dressing with it, and now you have soft, sweet dressing. Yuck. It makes me mad when I order somewhere and you got this corn cake shit that's not cornbread. Cornbread is coarse and in a skillet.
Crumbly. It's crumbly.
Yes. And it's wonderful when you have chili and all kinds of stuff you eat with cornbread, but sweet cornbread is an abomination, and I think you should be sent to your room.
I love sweet cornbread. Mondo, everybody don't want to eat that civil rights cornbread.
Well, I do. I'm proud of my people and where we're from.
Okay.
All right.
I thought you were going to say Civil War cornbread. It could be Civil War cornbread,
no,
too.
No, civil rights, though, is kind of funny.
Funny? Oh, it's much funnier.
let's lift, you know, we have an obligation not just to entertain and inform, but we have an obligation to lift up. And so all the people who are feeling, you know, dejected or whatever, or like disappointed, shit. Or like
yes,
shit.
Yes,
okay.
They flaunted it though, man. They flaunted it, man. I don't know about y'all, but I'm been out and they flaunting it. You know what I'm saying?
Who's like, flaunting it?
The winners.
Okay.
The old school
MAGA.
Look like Steven Cousins, though.
I just drank water. I'm gonna spit out.
Look, when I'm up there at the promenade, that Friday, man, when I tell you they out like you usually would see like in the course of the day, you might see one or two with the hats on and. Man, they were. It was like it was a parade of them.
They were
with the babies, everything. You know what I'm saying? The babies had the hats on. All of you coming up the darn thing, and you had the ones with the new one hats. Make a great. And they had the black ones, the new black ones.
Okay.
The new black joints.
You know what frightens me though is they're got their big old 250 truck dualies with the big, huge flags on the back of the before the election. And they're driving around with these huge flags unfurling on the highway that say Trump. And you go, okay, yeah, they're campaigning. That's, you know, but it's over now. Why do we got to be driving around the block? You know, maybe even the day after, I get it. They were celebrating, but still it feels ominous. It feels as if it's almost a threat.
It's,
you know what I mean?
Black people have been observing that forever. It's like, you know, to generalize, you know, which we all do and which we're doing now. But it's like when black people protest and stuff, there's something traumatic has happened. But white people get mad when they win. They get mad and go off and start tearing up. Yeah, we won. It's like when y'all chill and the rest of the world just wants to chill.
It's over.
But for some reason, everything is like at a frenzy and it makes you feel like this and you just want to relax and the world just wants to, come on, man, just put it down for a minute. it ain't that serious. And so it's traumatic and we've been watching it forever, and I've been trying to have a mission of my own to just say, can we chill? Just chill.
We'll be better off storming the Capitol. I'm ready. Let's go, Ma.
If we storm the Capitol, we'd just be sitting on the steps smoking weed and listening to rap songs.
Me, you, and Steven can start it off.
Come on now. Can you imagine that rally?
We'll send Steven up there as the decoy.
Decoy, that's not right.
And then I get shot.
Hey, but look, your memory would live on.
Let me tell you something. If I stormed the Capitol, I would actually have a plan. Like, when I get there, I'm not going to go into the chamber and then go, well, what does this say? Let's see. They didn't even know what they were doing. That's the one thing I thought was laughable about that whole thing, is those guys busted in there and they're like, okay, now what?
Yeah, the dog caught the car, the roadrunner caught the coyote. Now what?
Now what? They didn't know what to do. They have no plan. Then, like, how are you going to take something over if you don't even know what you're taking over?
But see, your power is not that you would take over that way. It's that you would take over fabulous. You think you have to go in fabulous and start straightening things up and adding decorative.
Oh, no. All new upholstery.
That's the blueprint,
okay?
Man.
So, you know, that's the way you show your strength and you fight a bully. Okay, we're going to dance and do ourselves and be our do our thing. You know that at this time when we're being threatened with book bans and the college being fined for DEI or teaching what they call CRT or CT, whatever the hell, it's just comprehensive American history. And people are being fined for that. We have to maintain our repositories of truth. And you know that I've been involved with the Jim Crow Museum and their expansion, and they're still looking to expand to add all of the artifacts that they've curated so far. It's imperative now that they get that funding, that those artifacts are preserved, because we're losing access to that information. And that's not just for any one segment of society. We cannot fix what we won't face. And so that resource is there for everyone, in addition to all the other wonderful museums and historical sites that are preserving of the American history that some people would rather hide. I would just ask people if they can find it in their hearts during this holiday season to give what you can to help these institutions thrive. All right, where y'all gonna be this week? Steven?
I will be at Puppetry of the Penis all weekend long. Thursday, you know? Through, and I don't take off my clothes, no matter what my mother says. I am not a naked comedian.
Oh, says the man who has the Facebook post up for 3 weeks, standing in there posing.
Oh, like no. I didn't have it up for 3 weeks. The algorithm took it.
That was 3 weeks.
The algorithm took it. I swear to God. I was like, I've never had an algorithm even look at me twice.
You're and such now, an all-American like, boy. There you go. Dave, Skills, where are you going to be?
This Friday, I will be at Jimmy Kimmel's Show Those Skills Fridays, 11:30, and Sunday and Monday with Lunel and her show at 9:30 at Jimmy Kimmel's at the Lake Promenade.
You just
speaking
got
of somebody who also does not like sweet cornbread.
Huh?
Lunel doesn't like sweet cornbread either.
Oh, no, we're both Pisces. That's it. She know what's up. But you were mentioned in an article recently, Skill?
Oh, yes. Yes. That's why I was a little, like, had a couple of drinks earlier. Look, it was Vegas Vap magazine. They did an article on me. Send hot ticket, and they did, you know, just they did a piece on me and talked about my journey and my time here in Vegas, and now the accumulation of that and my own show on the Strip.
All right, well, congratulations.
Thank you, Mom.
I
thank you, bro.
I'm going to be with George Wallace this weekend, the 15th, 16th, and 17th at Tommy T's in Pleasanton, California. And then at the end of the month, I'm going to be doing Joe Claire's what is it in Bowie?
Banging and Bowie.
Banging and Bowie. That's it. Is it Bowie or Bowie? I'm gonna be there.
I think it's Bowie.
I'm gonna be banging and Bowie and banging and Bowie. Okay. So look for me there. And the show's coming up here on Midnight in the Martial Earth, we got some really good guests coming up. Really good. And so stay with us. If you like us, you know, like, comment. You know, I hate this kind of selling this show. I hope you watch it just because you like it. And, you know, but
tell your mama about it.
But you do. if you could help us out, just like, comment, share, tell somebody, and come back again. And if you have any suggestions, any questions you'd like to ask, or like for us to play around with, like, how much does the sun weigh? I don't know. But if you have any of those, drop them in the line. Let us know. Subscribe. And otherwise, once you do that, your commitment to us is done. You can go forth and have fun with your life until it's time to come back again and watch another Midnight in the Martianverse. Y'all take it easy. We'll see you next time.
Bye.
She got a way no one can do it like that. Her own style, no one can wear that hat. Hey, don't you know that the queen is back? She's back, she's back. She withstands the test of time. When it comes to strength, she comes to me.